What do you want to talk about? Jackie?
You touched on it a little bit in the last talk, but I was just curious to ask a pointed question of, like, you know, I can imagine this weekend could have been, like, from a dozen other, maybe more practical things. Like, what is, like, why Revelation did that for us at the top? And, like, what is it about Revelation that you felt like Village needed to hear now?
I would argue it is very practical. But yes, no, I hear you. Well, I mean, of all the things. I do think, there's a couple of things. My head's been in it for the last year or so, just off and on, being reading through it and being wanting to understand it myself, but also going, my instinct is that this is a book of the Bible and quite a critical, you know, okay, well, all books of the Bible are important, but you know what? I think if you don't know what Nahum says, you might be okay. I think Revelation is quite critical. It's not, guys, 50 years ago, Revelation was the problem. Like, as all the isms were in full flight argument 150 years ago. It's not quite the same anymore. Now it's just ignorance. I don't know what it says, rather than too much knowledge of the details. And so I think I wanted to help God's people with that, to be able to open it for themselves, get something out of it, at least begin to. But I do think that with the time that we live in, people are kind of, that anxiety, that message of that kind of picture of blessedness, I think is radically skewed. And Revelation, I think, is a great antidote to that. So, yeah, just some of that. But, yes, I hope that we'll see that it is quite practical, particularly maybe not practical in the sense of, okay, here's how you're going to, you know, on Monday you're going to know how to do your vocational work better, but practical in the sense of realigning us to the mission that God's put us here to do, which I think is the great practical. Something like that. Yeah. That fair? Oh, all right. Yeah. Finn can ask me questions anytime, so.
I didn't even ask
you. You don't know what our office life looks like. And, need context for that.
It's helpful to think about our identity as individuals, but then part of the church is in like how our church is. But do you think this applied to the idea of the global church, and how can we take decisions or do things that reinforces our part of an identity as a global church?
Yeah, I think to a certain extent, it's very hard, right? In John's time, the idea of a global church is fantasy. You know what I mean? Like, why does he write to just the churches in Asia? That's all they would know. They don't know a person from Jerusalem, really. Like, John would be the only person they might know from Jerusalem. That person might come in once every couple of, you know, months, maybe, that would get them some news. And so I think it is a tricky question. It's a tricky answer, I think, in terms of going, what does a modern communications world that does have a knowledge of the church, wider church? I think my answer is, I think we should, in some sense, identify with the wider church and have it. So I think we should, and probably need to a little bit better, have a solidarity, is maybe the word I would give, with the wider church, particularly what's going on in the world to the church and around the church. But I do think that the picture of the... So let me give you two pieces of biblical evidence on this. Most of the concerns that the New Testament is written to, particularly the letters, is to a particular church in a particular area, and that is to be the central focus. But every now and then you get these little drips like, okay, we're taking up an offering for the church in Jerusalem because it's going through a famine. You get that every now and then. So I would say that, for me, that's kind of the scale. It's primary, your local church, where you can invest in and have an influence and impact on, with some awareness and every now and then some action towards wider, more global church. And I think that's a general kind of position that I would take. If you want to give it a percentage of 80, 20 or 90, 10, I don't know, but something around that. Is that fair?
Yeah.
Finn, what was your question, mate?
About the first talks, how would you suggest to know when to differentiate when a passage is being literal versus when it's poetic?
Great question. First is its literature type. If it's poetry, if it's apocalyptic, if it's parable, you should start with it's probably symbolic, unless we're told it's literal. Okay, so just to put it out here, John is literally in Patmos. He's not symbolically in Patmos, yeah? You can know that. But in most other parts of Revelation, you should assume first that it's symbolic and second that it's, if there is an explanation or some reason to think it could be literal, in the way we use that word, to go there. In a narrative, Jesus's gospel accounts, we should assume that it's literal in that it's an event that's actually happening. So I think genre, context is always king. After that, you're looking for things like, does it get explained as a symbol? Or is that, the other piece to that is there somewhere in the Old Testament that might suggest this is more symbolic? But generally speaking, I would say the genre and context answers the question for you. As to what symbol is, that's a nice question. But yeah, whether it is symbolic or, yeah.
I was going to piggyback off that from, like, what I've been taught about Revelations too. Like, the audience plays, like, a massive role. It's like those seven churches being under the, like, imperial pressure of Rome. Like, a lot of the symbols we would read and be like, ooh, I don't know what the woman with the earth means, you know? And, like, I don't know what the cups are about. But to that population and, like, that culture, it was, like, pop culture references. Like, they know that you're referencing the Old Testament in that bit, and they know that, oh, like, those numbers have this sort of cultural meaning. I feel like having, like, the backdrop of who is the audience and, like, what's going on for those seven churches helps you to navigate, like, this isn't a symbol for my time, it's a symbol referencing that time, and it comes with the same meaning. Like, the issues that they're facing are very similar to the issues that we're facing. But I feel like that was really helpful for me in navigating what the symbols mean and where do I go to find out what symbols mean. Because, like, there's so many random takes. So you're like, oh, I feel like that's wrong. And I'm not sure why I feel like that's wrong. But it's super random. But
yeah. The classic example is the church in Laodicea. You might be familiar with it. I wish that you were hot or cold, but because you're lukewarm, I want you to speak out of my mouth. That's the classic example in terms of, the misreading is, oh, God wants us to either be hot, like on fire for God language, or cold, not on fire at all. He'd prefer that than lukewarm, but that's not what it's saying. In its historical context, you had three types of water in Laodicea. You had hot water, which was really good for, you know, hot baths and these sort of things. Cold water, which is really refreshing, and it's good. So cold water is a good thing. It's really healthy. It had healing properties. But then you had the lukewarm water, which was awful, and no one wanted to drink. So you understand the historical. So I think that's sometimes true, even as I do think you've got to be a little bit careful, I would say, sometimes, in that some of the background symbolic stuff is contested, I guess, and questionable. And sometimes it's deliberately vague because it's meant to go across history. So we'll see this in our talk tomorrow. Is that some of it's vague because you're meant to see a symbol of a city rather than think literally Babylon, for instance. Yeah. But yeah, no. Thanks, man. Cool.
You mentioned, like, Christ saving us into the church and mentioned, like, Sundays, Middle East up. Are you able to, like, expand, like, I suppose, a more broader picture of what church is, or should look like, assume Christ and just say it isn't the 2 hours on the Sunday, 2 hours from the week, and that's fun. Like, what is it? We'll say pastors save us into this day with a more than just a 4 hour slot. But with
what that means, the 1% is judging.
Yeah, for sure. I guess it's the thing of it's not less than. How do I describe it? So you see the first disciples, right? Like when in Acts 2, first people become Christians, what is their initial response? It's to meet together daily. You think about the idea of the new creation and that picture of the new creation, it's always gathered together. And so I guess I just want to say that that's kind of the trajectory picture. Our kind of trick is, how can we be as gathered as possible, as often as possible, in the context that allows us? You know what I mean? Like, there are some, here we find the issue of our great wrestle of the culture and time we live in, right? In terms of, you talk to Christians, or you see when we went over to Vanuatu, you see this, very natural for them to spend time with each other far more regularly than we would say is comfortable or normal. But they're kind of doing life together lots of the time. These are communities without backyards or fences. So my answer to that question, and I guess the wrestle is, what does this look like practically? But my answer, at least in principle, is the shift for us is to try and be more of what we probably are. More than what the Western church sees as norm. Even as I don't necessarily think it's realistic or whatever, I'm not advocating let's go all we'll buy out somewhere out of Dubbo, let's do commune, we're off. I'm not advocating, we've got to continue to live in the culture that we do, but push more into God's picture of blessedness. And so I guess all that is to say, I think for us, in terms of practicalness, it really is always down to, at the moment, that word of priority, I think. That hard, really hard word of, you are faced with incredible amounts of competing priorities. That's the reality. The village, 1,000 years ago, it doesn't have many other things pulling at it. That's why it's not that big a burden to go, we turn up. Actually, that's the thing we're kind of looking forward to, because that's where our entertainment is, that's where our, our problem is, there are so many things pulling you away. And the great wrestle, I think, for the modern Christian is to go, have I said yes to too many things that hinder me from that regular gatheredness? Not just on, and I'm not just talking on a Sunday here, I'm talking about the other things you would do that you would consider really viably doing, like catching up more often in houses or as mums playing together or whatever. The reason why you struggle to do these things is because there are so many other things you feel up for. And that is the great challenge before us, I think, for all of us. And I include myself in this, guys. I would probably do more things with you if I didn't feel pulled towards my introversion or other stuff. I don't know what anyone's going to say if I say, is that okay? And I'm not going to ask you to do that, but one day, one of you go, no, I don't think you answered my question. Anyway, yeah. Adam.
Tim, do you think, you said to me, to all of us tonight, today, you've been studying Revelation. Obviously, you've studied Revelation way before you said in the last 12 months you've been studying Revelation. As Christians, Revelation is the last book of the Bible. We have to get our heads around that. Do you think it's fair, we owe it to ourselves, to read the Word a lot more with all these distractions you're mentioning? Because if we are questioned by someone who wants to come to the faith, we should be able to give you some sort of answer. Now, I personally think Revelation just does my head in. I've been trying to understand it for a long time. I was born in 1968. So I can tell you now, I've been involved with this for a long time. But rather than turn myself inside out, I personally couldn't give a lot of people on the street an answer about Revelation. But we owe it to ourselves to read the Word and ask the Holy Spirit to reveal the truth to us in some way, shape, or form.
Yeah, let me cover this answer in a funny way. I read an article by, you know, other pastors, Gospel Coalition article a little while ago, and they said a great tragedy in the church is happening, that people don't preach the Old Testament enough. People are preaching the New Testament far more than the Old Testament, and they're avoiding certain books in the Old Testament. There's an interesting argument. It's the question of, like, is every book in the Bible the same profitability as every other book? And I would have liked to write an article against that, saying, no. There is a reason why I'm not just going through the Bible on our Sundays from Genesis to Revelation, right? Or backwards, if you like. I guess what I want to say is I do want to help us to be comfortable. One of the reasons we're doing Revelation is I want us to be comfortable with every book of the Bible. However, I would also say it's more than, I would almost encourage you that when you receive, if you're engaging with people and they said, I've heard this or this, but Revelation is the last book that I would go to when engaging with people about stuff, because it is incredibly difficult. As someone who spent a year in it, I still feel like I am just touching some of the surfaces of it. I reckon wisdom, I'm trying to think of the passage, I think it's in my brain. Anyway, we are encouraged, even as we engage, particularly outsiders, to use a level of wisdom. And I think the level of wisdom is to be very careful about things that we engage, we can don't engage with. One of my great mistakes in evangelism in my early years of having a crack was that I would often get pulled into the rabbit holes that I quite enjoy to have arguments about, that other people would pick in, that it doesn't get you anywhere. The best thing I've ever learned in having conversations with people, especially non-Christians, is just keep pulling them back to the gospel. Keep coming back to the central things.
Well, I was challenged by Ben when we were out there having the group discussion. Now, Ben's a Christian, and I'm a Christian. So how am I? It was hard for me to even answer Ben, because I haven't been looking at the book of the word. When we've been here today, I looked at Revelation 13. Mm. At the start of Revelation 13, it's all symbolizations, but then John discusses it in simple terms and lays it all out, and it's actually fantastic. So it's not all bewildering.
No.
But it threw the challenge down to me, because Ben's a Christian. So it's not even a non-Christian. It's even a brother in Christ who's throwing down the gauntlet for me to see if I can answer, give him an answer to what I'm reclaiming that I say is in the book of Revelation. So, you know, I'm not even faced with just a non-Christian. It's even a brother in Christ.
Yeah, for sure. I think, again, it doesn't mean that every single Christian needs to be able to answer every single piece of Revelation. I don't think that's where we're trying to go. I think, again, I would go, this is where we need to start with, baby steps. We start with knowing a big picture of Revelation. Where's it going? What's the big things? Mm. And then, as you go along in your Christian journey, there are going to be other things that are going to be more profitable at the stage of your Christianity. I don't say to new Christians, go and read Revelation. I don't say to them, go and read it from the start. I say, go and read the Gospels, go and read Ephesians, these sort of things. It's just, I think this is where the wisdom comes in. And more accessible. And I don't think a Christian should feel, because of the reality of limited time, limited resource, I don't think every Christian should feel beholden to understand every book of the Bible really well. I think it's okay if you don't, even as I think we should seek understanding. Hold attention in there, you know, you're with me? Pursue. If you feel a particular drawing to Revelation, that's great. You'll be blessed by it if you go into it with the right eyes. But not every, I'm not going to demand on us, guys, we need to be masters of Revelation in 3 years' time. You're not going to be masters of any book in the Bible in 3 years' time. That's okay.
Could I ask a question? Okay. Modestus, I need right.
Revelations, there's different shops and different genres of literature that we have, you know, like horror and romance and fantasy, and they're all written with certain sort of characteristics and things that help us understand how to read, and we know those things when we read them. And apocalyptic literature, it's a genre of literature. It's not just in Revelation. That's correct, isn't it?
Yep.
So my question is, when John, you, this is just your thoughts because I don't think we know for sure, but what do you think, when John sees something, does he see it in terms of apocalyptic literature, or did he have a vision, an understanding from God, and then thought, the best way I can communicate this is to use all the symbolism of apocalyptic literature, I'm going to write it up in that way because I think that was probably the best way to express it. Do you think that's what happened?
I think so. Let me give two bits to the question, two answers. If you got given a dream or a vision, how would you describe it? I think that's what John, literally the challenge before John, he does see a vision, a picture, a dream, whatever you want to, language. He sees images, he's getting a vision, and then his great challenge is to put it in words. But I'd say he's also doing a second piece, which is this. He also wants to interpret that vision for you. And so he's using very deliberate words and doing very deliberate things to point you to what vision means, particularly from the Old Testament. You can describe a vision in a number of different ways, but he is putting it in code for you as well so that you'll turn back to Old Testament things and realize, why does John use so much language that comes from, say, Daniel or Ezekiel? It's not just that they use apocalyptic literature, it's that they're books of the exile. So he's pointing you back to Israel's exile. He's going, remember Israel in exile, remember what that was like. That's kind of you guys. That's your time. Remember what happened to Israel in exile. He'll give you other funny examples. So Jericho is another kind of image that gets used within Revelation. Do you remember what happened with Jericho? Jericho, the city, the evil city, is destroyed. But God's people are saved. God's people, Rahab, are saved out of it. So that's why he got like scarlet cords and all these sorts. So John will describe what he's seeing. And I guess you could also say God is giving it in the vision so that John could. He's trying to point you to Old Testament things. So, yeah.
Yeah, that's
a
fun question.
Yeah.
Well, I understand. We're probably out of time.
No.
One more. Last one.
I knew I was... I'm deliberately not reading the room at all. There's heaps of reference to who Jesus is and what he's like in the bit that we read.
Yeah.
I'm thinking particularly the bit that looks like a quote from verse 7. That's, you know, everyone's going to mourn when they see him. And then the lengthy description, verse 12 through to the end of the bit. What can you give us just the, like, it seems really important that this is what Jesus is like and that it's delivered by him. The experience is so overpowering that John falls on his face like he's dead. The angel kind of gets him up for the job. What's all that symbolism? How would that have comforted readers of the first century, or not?
Yeah.
Like what are we meant to...
Yeah.
I guess I'm just saying, John spends heaps of time spelling out this kind of crazy image of Jesus. What's the power and significance of that for the rest of Revelation and the context of the band?
Yeah, I think given time, it would have been included in talk one. It's seeing... think about the other place. Isaiah 6 is where Isaiah... comes face to face with God in his throne room. And what is his response? It's like overwhelming. My God, I'm a sinner of a man. You know, I'm a man of unclean lips. I think these images of Jesus are there to kind of humble you in your sinfulness and smallness, and to see a very big God, a very powerful God. That's the one who's on the throne. I think at the same time, it's there in some form of warning. If you look through the letters to the churches, Jesus both reminds them who he is in his bigness. Hey, you don't want me coming in and removing your lampstand because you haven't been following me faithfully. But also, I'm the one who can write your name in the book of life. Like, I'm the one who has that power. So it is, it's seeing Jesus in his Jesusness, not his son of manness. His son of godness and not his son of manness, I think is John's purpose. Okay, yes, you're cutting me to the heart in the sense that of all the things I feel like I'm not including, and I apologize. I know you,
that's my favourite comment question. I always got a comment question.
You know, and I appreciate, I know you don't try and do that, but this is what triggers me about. This is what has killed me about Revelation, the sheer amount of stuff that we could have engaged with. All right.
Thank you.